This Hedge School series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Hedge School with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. Our topic today is crowdfunding the revolution, the underground administration. A consistent theme of our Hedge Schools on the revolutionary period has been that the armed struggle of the IRA was only the tip of the iceberg of a much broader mobilization against the British, exemplified by a quote-unquote underground administration. But what was that? How was it funded? How effective was it? So to answer these questions, I'm joined by John Borgonovo, who lectures in the School of History at UCC and is co-editor of the Atlas of the Irish Revolution, published by Cork University Press in 2017. Caoimhe Nic David, who is a senior lecturer in modern history at the University of Sheffield. Patrick O'Sullivan Green, who is the author of Crowdfunding the Revolution, The First Daw Loan and the Battle for Irish Independence, which was published last year by Eastwood Books. And finally, we're joined by Brian Hughes, who lectures in Mary Immaculate College, University of Limerick, and is the author of Defying the IRA, Intimidation, Coercion, and Communities During the Irish Revolution. And that was published by Liverpool University Press in 2017. And this Hedge School is supported by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport, and Media under the Decade of Centenaries 2012 to 2023 initiative. Now, Patrick, seeing as we stole the title of your book for this particular Hedge School, you know, Crowdfunding the Revolution, brilliant title, by the way, what are we talking about here? What were the challenges faced by the revolutionary movement?
Well, Tommy, we're looking at a new generation of young leaders who not only wanted to get rid of the ties to the United Kingdom through the Act of Union, but also which, you know, united Ireland politically and administratively to the United Kingdom, but also they wanted to remove the economic changes that had happened since the Act of Union, in particular the merger of the Irish and British exchequers in 1817, where the Irish tax revenues were now concentrated and sent to London. And this new generation were looking not just political, but they wanted economic and social deliverance. And to do that, you know, they were looking at what was happening in Paris and in New York, and in particular in the emerging states in Europe. And they set about setting up their own nation state. And, you know, setting up a new nation state requires organization, funding, and sometimes ruthlessness.
Now, just in terms of the practical origins of this, Caoimhe, could it go to you? Because I'm assuming that the origins of this can be traced back to the post-1916 period, when there was a quite an elaborate, you know, prisoner support, prisoner funding operation. Could you fill us in on that, Caoimhe, please?
Yeah, so after the rising, after the surrender, and you have the wave of executions, and then immediately those who are the prisoners are shipped off to prison camps and to prisons themselves in England and in Wales. And there's, you know, around about 1,000 people who eventually are retained in the process and retained in those penal institutions. And those were the prime movers, the organizers who were behind the Easter Rising, who were heavily embedded in the IRB and the Irish Volunteers. And the people who were left behind then had to do some of the mopping up and attempt to reconstruct all those Republican networks and organizations that had been sort of torn asunder by the Rising itself and by the punishment of the Rising. And so I should say also that the urge to raise money to support the prisoners, that comes from a long-standing tradition within Irish nationalism. We see it all the way back in 1848. We see it in the 1860s and the 1870s, and again in the 1880s with the treason felony prisoners. So in one sense, it's not really surprising that these organisations emerge appealing to the Irish nationalist public to support prisoners in 1916 and 1917. But what is new and distinctive, I think, are a couple of features. First is the amount of money that's raised and the different countries that this money comes from. And the second is the role of women in these organizations.
Just go back to the first point there. What sort of figures are we talking about? How much money are we talking about here?
Well, in the by tens of millions by current day standards. So it's a not insubstantial sum. And one of the interesting things is, you know, some people give according to their means. So some people give very small amounts anonymously. Some parishes raise funds collectively. And then you have right up to, you know, larger sums that are collected by dioceses overseas in America, in Australia in particular, and sent back to the organization in Dublin. So, you know, the Catholic Church and the Irish diasporic Catholic Church throws a lot of its weight behind these fundraising efforts and are involved in all sorts of sort of sponsored gift sales, concerts, charity fundraisers that provides a sort of and that gives us a sense of the direction of travel, I think, in terms of where public opinion is going in the aftermath of rising and before the elections of 1918.
Now, the second point you raised there was the involvement of women in this process.
Yeah. So the one thing that I should make clear is that there are two sort of rival organizations that exist initially. So you have the National Aid Fund and the Volunteers Defendants Fund. And the National Aid Fund is more rooted in, I suppose, constitutional nationalism. The Lord Mayor of Dublin, who's a kind of IPP aligned figure at that point, he's affiliated with it. And that fund, for those reasons, is viewed with intense hostility by the Volunteer Dependents Fund, which is led by widows and by sisters and by a great many of the Republican women who were left behind after 1916, principal among them Kathleen Clark. The initial funds that got that organization going was Clonmacnoise money that Tom Clark gave to his wife Kathleen, that she buried in her garden in North Dublin City, in the run-up to the rising itself. So you have initially two rival organizations. This clearly isn't going to make, you know, sense in terms of appealing to the public. It's going to confuse them. So there are efforts made to amalgamate the organizations, and the condition upon which Kathleen Clark agrees to amalgamate the organizations is for some of these, you know, constitutional nationalist figures to be shepherded off. And what that means is that when the new organization takes shape, the Irish National Aid Association and Volunteer Dependence Fund, it's quite a mouthful, women are in key positions on that organizing committee. And that the presence of those women in those key positions is maintained at least up until the release of Republican prisoners from, you know, into 1917. And then you see a bit of a change of personnel a little bit, and somebody named Michael Collins gets into a key position, but women were centrally involved in at the outset of that organization.
But basically, Keith, what you're saying is once the lads get out of jail, they shove the women to one side, and Collins in particular, and they take over this operation.
Although I don't think I think some of the women were quite supportive of that. They saw that, you know, they recognized the organizational capacity of these men. It's not, you know, another important figure is Liam Clark, who's no relation to Kathleen Clark. He becomes a really important traveling organizer for the INA VDF. And Kathleen Clark is close to him. She's supportive of them. She views them as, you know, she views these men as assets to the organization in pursuit of the common goal. But certainly from, you know, as looking back at the organization, we can see that pattern where the women are doing the hard work, setting it up and getting it going. And the men come out of prison and, you know, move into those positions and move the organization on quite definitively.
But that was just accepted at the time. John Borgonovi, you want to come in on that point?
Yeah, just that, you know, we also got to remember that right after 1916, there was no way for the public to express their support for the rising. Like you couldn't demonstrate, you get arrested. The police were breaking up demonstrations. You couldn't, there was censorship in the newspapers. You could get under DORA, you could get arrested for almost anything. So the raising of funds also offered kind of a safe way for people to express support for the rising and opposition to the executions. And so what you see is these are really the first. So, and when we think about what happens with Sinn Féin doesn't really emerge until a year after the rising. And so what the INAD, what is it? Was it equivalent? INAVDF? What they do is they have demonstrations and a real visible presence in urban centers and actually just across the country. And these are, and the people who join these and the people who organize these become leaders of Cumann na mBan. They become leaders of Sinn Féin. They get a lot of them go into the volunteers and they become an expression and a visible symbol of the new independence movement at a time when that independence movement has been driven underground by the crown, by Dublin Castle.
Patrick, can I just go back to you, because mention has been made of the prison camps and you know, Frongoch, for example, in Wales. Now, Frongoch is often described as a university of revolution. Was it, to some extent, a university of underground administration?
Well, I'm not sure we'd go that far, Tommy, but for sure, you know, we are talking about, you know, educated, well-trained people who are interned in Frongoch. And, you know, one of those was Michael O'Reilly, who had, you know, started, well, certainly conceived the idea of setting up a new national insurance company in Ireland, in Frongoch. In fact, he became obsessive about it, so much so that when he left Frongoch, he contacted Michael Collins, and Michael Collins encouraged him to go about setting up a new insurance company. And together with, and the objective being was to stop the flow of insurance premiums out of Ireland. And this was a, you know, a key talking point in Sinn Féin, and certainly driven by the writings of and the talks of Arthur Griffith. So when he left Frongoch, he got experience in the insurance industry, and together with five other volunteers who had been interned, they set up the a new national insurance company to take on the incumbent British companies in Ireland.
Right. So and that company, of course, still exists today, New Ireland Assurance. Okay, let's move the discussion on here now, because the general election takes place in December 1918. Dáil Éireann assembles in January 1919. So, John Borgonovo, what were its priorities when it first met?
So, you know, when we think about just the emergence of how fast everything moved, you know, Sinn Féin really emerges as a new party in kind of the summer of 1917, and then they fight the conscription crisis in early to mid 1918, and then bam, there's an election, and at the end of 1918, the Dáil gathers in January 1919. They didn't really have a detailed governing program. What they had was they had a propaganda campaign to convince domestic Irish, British, and international audiences that Ireland should receive independence or self-determination. And so what they used the Dáil for and the Dáil program for was to demonstrate Ireland's case to an international audience, basically. So, you know, we just talked about the economics. There was a whole detailed idea of Ireland as an economic unit, having basically its own, a separate economy from Britain, and how that would bring about a lot of wealth, and it would lift up Ireland out of poverty if it was in charge of it. So if it could trade with its international partners, if it could trade with Europe, and it could not be sucked into the big British industrial shadow. So there was arguments about that. There were arguments about its natural resources. They had hearings on fisheries. They had hearings on hydraulic power, on new ways of pursuing agriculture. The idea being that an independent Irish government would lead to all these practical benefits for the public, and that in the court of international opinion, Ireland had the population, it had the resources, it had the wealth, and it had the historic case to deserve international recognition for its independence claim. And that program kind of morphs into an international campaign to secure recognition for the Irish Republic as declared.
That involves sending Sean T. O'Kelly and a delegation to Paris. Now,
yeah, I mean the first kind of in the short term, there's a big peace conference going on in Versailles, which is going to deliver self-determination for countries like Poland, what's going to become Czechoslovakia, Finland. It creates all these new mandates in the Middle East. And the Irish have really high expectations that their historic case is going to get recognized and that they'll get support from the United States and all will be well. But unfortunately, things don't go as they wished in Paris, and the international recognition is not forthcoming.
And I'm assuming, you know, the having Sean T looking well, feet, you know, eating the best of food and so on, that's part of the propaganda exercise, you know, that this is a proper internet, you know, a delegation of a state or a country that should be recognized.
Absolutely. And they're also fighting against all these longstanding tropes that is used to deny Ireland self-determination, that the Irish are primitive, that they are violent prone, that they're disorderly. So the whole campaign, and this is also feeds into everything we talk about with the Dáil, what they're trying to show their face to the international world is of an orderly self-government, that Ireland can govern itself. It does not need Britain to govern it, that Ireland will be more peaceful and more prosperous and more orderly under an independent state. And that's what kind of everything they do internationally is about.
Patrick, can I go to you next, though? Because, you know, specifically, like, what did, by the way, just like to point out to listeners that Patrick is not a historian. He's a chartered accountant. Some of my best friends are chartered accountants, by the way. No, just have to say, having my own limited experience of running various businesses, accountants have this ability to shine a light, sometimes too much light, on the inner workings of an operation. But with that knowledge, Patrick, what did the Dáil spend its money on, the early Dáil spend its money on?
Well, yeah, Tommy, that was one of the big problems, you know, for the first 9 months of the Dáil. It pretty much had to fake it until it could make it, because it didn't have any funds. And the first source of funding was the Self-Determination Fund, which was an attempt to accumulate some of the money being returned from a fund that was used to fight conscription. So the Dáil loan itself, which was, you know, going to be the major funding of the new state, really did not commence until September. And Dáil Éireann continued to operate during that period. But very much so, Dublin Castle and London looked at it as a bit of a sideshow, a stage play, and that they expected the elected representatives to come crawling back to Westminster because they wouldn't have any funding. So the funding to any nation state, you know, funding is critical. And, you know, it's no coincidence that Dáil Éireann was finally prohibited in September 1919, just as the loan was the first newspaper advertisements were sent to the editors by the advertising agency that Collins engaged.
Just to clarify on this loan now, Patrick, is this the one for which bonds were issued, both in Ireland and around the world? Is that the same thing we're talking about?
Yeah, so
here?
The first Dáil loan had two aspects to it. It was raising £250,000 in Ireland and £250,000 in the US, which was the equivalent of about $1.2 million. And that was showing that, you know, the term bonds was deliberately used. This was a nation fund, or it was a government, a legitimate, albeit self-declared government, raising funds just like any other state would. There was the obvious difficulty in that this was a self-declared state. It was unrecognized. And the funds raised in Ireland, once Dáil Éireann was prohibited, it became subject to the regulations previously mentioned, to DORA, and in particular to the Crimes Act of 1887, which between the two pieces of legislation made it illegal to gather in crowds of more than three. So promotion was difficult. And it made funding for a prohibited organization, the Dáil loan campaign itself, was would become an illegal subscription.
It's also a pretty hard sell, Patrick. I mean, with your financial analyst hat on, I mean, would you recommend anyone buying these bonds, you know, for a state that does not yet exist? I just leave that one hang for a minute, because I only move on to another point, which in the notes that you sent me, I found this amazing, that in 1919 and in 1920, only 6% of Dáil expenditure went to the Department of Defence, which I found that amazing. Right now, I'm assuming it's different in 1921, but let's just stick with the early period. Now, does that include local levies? Brian, I want to bring you in on this, because And maybe, Patrick, could you answer that? Like, because the IRA did levy a local arms levy. And I'm going to go to Brian on that. So it didn't include that, Patrick, is that right?
No, it only included the funds raised directly through the self-determination fund and DAW loan and central funding, not local funding.
Okay, so that it doesn't give the complete picture, if you like. Brian, could I go to you? Maybe you could fill in this gap. What was the IRA arms levy? And was it an offer that couldn't be refused?
Yeah, the IRA arms levy was collected locally and therefore would have been spent locally as well and organised by local IRA units. Really, it was to fund the equipment they needed to stay in the field. Now, it's very hard to know exactly what the money was spent for when it was handed over by locals. But the idea was it was to buy the guns and ammunition, essentially, to keep the IRA fighting. And the amount was usually decided, again, by the local unit. And you'll find different accounts of the amounts that people were asked to pay. Sometimes it was based on the rateable value of the property, three pence in the pound. In some cases, it was a flat fee. In some places, they base it on how much they thought they might get. So the local landowner might be asked to give over more money than a worker in a town. But really, it was about the local units and enforcing it and collecting it in a way they saw fit. And in terms of whether it was something that was an offer that could be refused or not, that probably depended on where you are and maybe who you are as well. Bureau of Military History statements tend to suggest, if you kind of read those, they tend to suggest that these levies were handed over quite willingly, sometimes almost cheerily, and that it was a small number of sort of...
Irish people handing over levies cheerily, I don't think so.
No, it does sound a little bit too good to be true, but it sort of makes sense for them to think about this afterwards in a way that it was generally supported by this willing public, and that those who refused were this kind of small group of stubborn loyalists who just needed a bit of extra gentle persuasion to hand over their money. And you'll rarely get talk of very serious opposition to the arms levy in these statements, but actually Cork is maybe something of an outlier here, and like so much else, Cork stands out a little bit. I think John can talk about this a bit more.
Yeah, John, how did this operate in practice on the ground? By the way, despite his accent, John Borgonova is at this stage an honorary citizen of the people of Cork. John, how did it work in practice on the ground?
Well, just to reinforce what Brian was saying, one thing, and what you were saying before, one thing people don't understand is the local IRA units didn't get a cent from Dublin. So none of this money was coming out from Dublin. The only money that was really being raised was being controlled by Collins and General Headquarters. So all the local units had to fund themselves. And any arms they received very few arms from their General Headquarters. There were very few arms coming into the country. And those arms that were brought in or distributed, they had to buy. So if Collins says, I have five rifles for you, you had to pay, $10 or £10 a rifle. You weren't getting them for free. So where do you get that money from? So that's kind of what Brian's saying. So the levies, the better organized units are a little more efficient. They're kind of going door to door, but in some cases you get, as you said, people who won't pay and they come back and, the solution is to seize livestock. So what you have is if you're not paying, your levy, that's your bill has been handed out, the IRA will come at night and they'll take whatever they think is worth the equivalent in terms of cattle generally. And they had a whole network of cattle, of kind of nighttime cattle runs, where they would drive cattle from the seized farms and they'd have a safe pasture miles away. And then over the course of a few nights, they might run the cattle 20, 30, 40, 50 miles away and then sell them in a market. And then where the fingerprints won't be all over it. And then they would use that money, send that money back in lieu of the payment. And so you do get a fair bit of resistance. Brian could probably talk more about resistance. I know that there was a couple of farmers, they weren't killed for not paying the levy, but they reported and named the people who came around and seized their cattle. And then they were shot for that, and those because those IRA guys were arrested. But by and large, it wasn't you weren't looking at lethal intimidation, but you were being harassed if you didn't and threatened, definitely, if you didn't hand over the bill that had been handed out to you.
Now, Brian, just to go back to you, can we draw any conclusions about the political allegiance of those who paid or those who didn't pay?
I think one of the things about this is that maybe you can't, certainly not in very definitive or broad terms. So sort of as John was suggesting, there are people who refused on the ground, and sometimes they were loyalists. But often they weren't. You'll find, particularly in the contemporary record, rather than the sort of later reminiscences of veterans, people who will say they refused to pay a levy because they felt that the amount was unfair. And they might be Republican sympathisers, you know, or at the very least not be opposed to the Republican cause, but they feel that this amount is unfair. They can't afford it. You know, these are often very hard-pressed working people, and sort of handing over money like that is not necessarily an easy thing to do. It can also depend on the local dynamics in the area as well. And if you look at sort of a nice counterpoint to the Republican reminiscences of this is the Irish Grants Committee, which was a series of compensation files. Southern Irish loyalists could apply to compensation or for compensation to the British government in the mid-1920s. And actually, in quite a lot of those claim files, you'll find these self-professed Southern loyalists claiming to have either refused to pay a levy, and then refusing to pay the levy is what brought the attention of Republicans onto them. So sort of, as John was saying, very few cases where somebody would be shot for refusing to pay a levy, but often it brought other forms of intimidation or threat upon you, damage to property, cattle drives, even just, it sort of put them down as a marked man or a marked woman in the locality. And this was commented upon. But you'll have other self-professed loyalists who will claim that they paid the levy under threat. And that's part of their claim for compensation is, I handed over £5 to armed men who came to my door in the middle of the night. And so, people who paid maybe because they believed in the cause, but they paid because they were afraid. People who refused for a whole range of reasons as well.
Okay, let's move on to another level of funding and expenses indeed. You have the local government elections, Brian, in 1920, right? And many of these, and of course, Sinn Féin again swept the boards in many of these councils, and they switched their allegiance to Dáil Éireann. Now, how did that operate in practice, right? Presumably, local government was funded by rates. So were these rates now paid to Dáil Éireann? And if they were, how? How were rates collected or diverted from the British government?
Yeah, so most of the local authorities, most of their revenue came from the local rates, the locally collected poor rate. There wasn't all of their funding. There was also funding that came in from things like dog licenses or car licenses. And the local government board, which would have been the central organiser of local government in Ireland, they provided grants. One of the things, though, the LGB did after councils declared allegiance to Dáil Éireann and refused to submit their books to audit was remove those government grants. So the poor rate became really, really crucial to funding local government and to keeping local services on the go. And the way it would have been originally collected was a rate collector would collect the money. It would have been in sort of 2 6 monthly moties each year. The local council would strike the rate. The rate would be collected in these two equal installments by a collector who was bonded. And that would go to a treasurer, which is usually a local branch of the bank, and then be distributed to the council that way. But Clare County Council were the first to operate this kind of workaround once the Dáil Éireann local government department were sort of taken over. And this was that a number of local trustees would be appointed. The rate collectors would resign and then be reappointed, which in theory the Dáil argued would sort of remove them from their legal obligations. They would collect the rates, they would give them to these local trustees, and then through a bonded paymaster, then the money handed over to the trustees would be given to the councils and dispersed that way. And so Clare did that first.
Even if they were pro Dáil Éireann councils?
Yeah, so that was the way to kind of get around the legal obligations, because what they wanted to do was a complete breach from the local government board. So going to the local government board appointed treasurer was something they wanted to avoid, or certainly initially that was the plan to avoid it. And then Clare County Council came up with this workaround first, and then the Dáil Éireann department under W.T. Cosgrave and Kevin O'Higgins recommended it for other councils. And it worked in some places, it didn't work in others, because this created all sorts of problems and dilemmas for rate collectors in particular, but also for rate payers. We have to bear in mind that when it came to collecting the rates, you know, we know now how all this ended up, but in 1920 or 1921, there was no guarantee that the dollar and local government department would survive and that it would prevail. So there was a fear about handing over money that, you know, may go missing or may be unaccounted for, and the rate collector would become liable for that money if it did go missing. Rate payers didn't necessarily want to hand over rates to a, you know, a Dáil Éireann collector and then find they were liable for those rates to a, you know, a local government board collector later on. So it created all sorts of problems on the ground, which in some councils were very good at collecting and managed to close their collections. In other places, it was really very problematic.
Now, John, did the British government just sit back and allow this to happen?
Well, I mean, Brian can talk more about the kind of some of the mechanisms they took at the local government board. But what they also did in terms of dealing with local bodies is as part of kind of another form of collective punishment, there was a compensation scheme for victims basically of communal or Republican violence. So what you get is, so ratepayers were held liable for acts of violence that were essentially carried out by the IRA or others or unknown other people, basically acts of communal violence. A victim could go to essentially to a court and they had kind of special hearings for these, and they would be compensated. And generally compensation might be anywhere from, if you were wounded, got shot, you might get 500 pounds. You people who were killed, their families might get 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 pounds. And these were levied on the local authorities, on a local corporation or the rural district council. And the idea was to basically make ratepayers pay for the violence that was part of this campaign. So through this scheme, basically local authorities were just given massive tax bills by the British. And you're talking about, I think, in Cork City, I think it was like £250,000 levied on ratepayers, which if paid over would bankrupt the corporation. And that's the idea. The idea was to compel ratepayers to stop acts of violence. But what ended up happening is you just get kind of the whole local government authority and these local bodies just, and a lot of times they kind of seize up and their finances become kind of ruined as a result.
Now, Creve, I want to bring you in there because in general elections, women got the vote, women over 30 got the vote in 1918, but they had been voting at local level, I think, for decades before that. So what was women's involvement in this whole underground local government situation?
Yeah, it's another strand that is part of the picture of how ordinary people contributed to the Republican campaign in non-military ways, right? And the Dáil administration was actually quite a good employer of women in 1920 and 21. And that's in contrast to what we might think about how the Free State emerged and wasn't such a good place for employing women, and with the various marriage bars and marriage bans and differential rates of pay that was introduced by Ernest Blyth, I think it was later on. But, you know, in 1920 and 1921, the Dáil administration was quite a progressive employer of women, as it were. And this is also in contrast to some of the campaigns that had been conducted by Great War veterans groups to, you know, to kind of squeeze out or edge out women from the civil service to provide jobs for veterans. So that's the first point that I want to make. And, you know, in the Department of Local Government, I think out of 36 or so office staff, 16 of these are women. So there's quite a high representation of women in those roles. So women are involved in the revolutionary administration as typists, as secretaries, a lot of women involved in propaganda work, in, you know, the construction and the composition of propaganda, as well as the distribution, as well as the printing. So women are involved sort of right across the board. They're heavily involved in the Sinn Féin party. Now, sometimes there's a you know, attention, one of the things that is attracting civil servants to kind of switch their allegiance to the Dáil government is the promise of standardized rates of pay, of more opportunities for progression, of less corruption in local appointments. These are all kind of part of some of the criticisms that are leveled at the old Dublin Castle controlled administration. There's a question of how do you attract these applicants? And W.T. Cosgrave is a stickler for having an above board, clean appointments procedure. So he actually wants to advertise in local newspapers without stipulating who the employer is. So only the successful candidate will be told who they're actually going to be working for. And of course, those who are working for Sinn Féin generally are doing so gratis, you know, free of charge. So they might be tempted to step across into the Dáil administration where they can get some sort of remuneration. So that's just one strand of women's work. And then, you know, you have Cumann na mBan women who are also engaged in what we might call kind of non-military activities. A lot of fundraising activities, action going on by Cumann na mBan. And if you look at the statistics, the areas of the country that tend to be less militarily active, that's where there tends to be a lot of fundraising efforts. So as these parts of the county, like Ulster, for example, as they are less military active, there's more time and more scope and more space for Cumann na mBan women to devote their energy to fundraising. So there's various levels at which women can become involved in revolutionary administration or revolutionary government or supporting the revolutionary efforts. And these areas are not just, you know, classic auxiliary, first aid, running intelligence. That will be more on the military side of things. But there's a whole other world that we can uncover as well.
Now, I want to move on to John and Dáil Courts. But before I do, John, I just want to go to Patrick, because on the related topic of the National Land Bank, which was discussed in the first Dáil. So, Patrick, could you just give us a definition of that first? And because I know it's related to the Dáil Courts, I'll bring John in then.
Yeah, Tommy, could I just add a quick point on what Quigley was saying? I mentioned about, you know, the new young generation of leaders and activists. And, you know, one of those was Eilish Ryan, who had, as she described herself, a good job. She just got promoted. So this is early 1920, just got promoted. Described herself as having bright prospects. And one day she received a note from Michael Collins to come to see him. And at that meeting, he offered her a job in the Department of Finance. And despite, you know, the strong career prospects Eilish had herself, she actually gave up that job, joined the Department of Finance, working over a shop on Mary Street, with the constant, you know, risk of raid and arrest. So for sure, throughout the Dáil administration, the women are playing a huge role in all aspects of the, in particular, of the loan campaign. Just on the National Land Bank, John may have some points to make here, but one of the biggest problems facing the young Dáil Éireann in 1919-1920 was a rise in agrarian conflict again. And one of the primary reasons for this was with the outbreak of the war, the British government issued British war bonds, which carried a relatively high rate of interest of up to 5%. The successful land acts, which enabled tenant farmers buy their land, offered landlords land stock, which paid a much lower rate of interest of about 3%. So it actually became uneconomical for landlords to actually sell their lands, and the Land Act provisions became obsolete in terms of tenants purchasing land. So the Dáil government had to very quickly come up with a solution to this, because their worry was that the political capital they had would be used to fight a new agrarian war rather than focusing people's attention on the relationship, the political relationship, and breaking the political relationship with the United Kingdom. So the National Land Bank was conceived by Robert Barton, an Anglo-Irish Protestant farmer, former British soldier, who worked very closely with Collins on setting up a new national land bank, one to address the agrarian issues by offering loans to farmers, and secondly, which is the more ambitious objective of Barton and Collins, was to become a financial centre of Ireland and take on the incumbent banks, you know, in particular Bank of Ireland, which had been established in 1783, and pretty much controlled the finances, not only of the national finances, but also the local government finances, in particular the Dublin Corporation.
John, can I bring you in then on how this intersects with the establishment of the Dáil Courts? I mean, what was their purpose? Was it revolutionary or conservative in impulse?
Well, so if we go back to the end of the First World War, 1917, 1918, you had kind of the rural economy was being disrupted because there were food shortages in Britain. And that drove the price of food just went way up. And what you started to see, and basically livestock and cattle became really lucrative for big farmers, and tillage farmers were getting squeezed. And as you said, like there was also much the land wasn't turning over as it had been under the Windebanks pre-war. So all this led to kind of an explosion in agrarianism in 1918, where you had people going out and seizing property and, you know, plowing land, knocking down. It was mainly directed against graziers, against cattle ranchers. And it was pretty scary, I think, for the Republicans, because they thought they were kind of losing control of the movement. So what you see in 1920s, you see it start to reemerge, and especially in areas where the police have been kind of driven underground as a result of the IRA offensive. And so you start, especially out west, Clare, Mayo, you start to get a lot of agrarianism. And it is seen as a real danger by the Republican leadership because, as we said before, they're trying to convince an international audience that an independent Ireland is going to be orderly. It's not going to be a Bolshevik communist revolution. It's going to be nice, restrained, responsible people. And the kind of violent seizure of land and kind of the midnight intimidation that's associated with a lot of that rural agrarianism was very much not in this public persona that the Republicans were trying to show the outside world. So it was really incumbent upon them to bring order into areas that had become disorderly because they felt it reflected upon them. So you start to see the first Republican courts, Dáil Courts, they're not centrally organized. They're not coming. It's Arthur Griffith isn't sending out orders. It's basically local Republican, local government and IRA units trying to resolve kind of an emerging anarchy. And that's when the courts really get in. And you also see something similar in the cities and big towns because the police have been kind of driven into their barracks. There's a lot of ordinary crime. There are massive bank robberies in all parts of the country. There are payroll robberies. There are people breaking in. There are burglaries. And this is so what you start to see is Republicans are like, okay, we got to get on top of this. We will show that we can govern the island. So they start to set up the courts. They also set up the IRA police. And all this reaps a lot of benefits, not just in terms of public support, because they like the idea of a little bit of law and order when it was missing, but also it is really good fodder for the international press. And they really glob onto this, which is why we talk about the Republican courts. But just to close out, I mean, when we think about the Republican courts, they don't really emerge until May and June 1920. You know, that's a year and months after the Dáil had first set up. So it's a reaction that then shows its benefits, and then the Republicans go all in on it.
Okay, so that seems to depict then that this underground administration that we are describing, it's inspired from the top, as Patrick has outlined, but also it's inspired from the bottom, John, as you just outlined, in things like the Dáil Courts. Brian, you want to come in there?
Yeah, just to say that there's a connection there between the Dáil Courts and the collection of the rates, and very significant anti-rates opposition, sometimes from individuals and sometimes from organised groups, particularly the Farmers Union and Ratepayers Associations. But the IRA ended up collecting rates in many places, particularly in Clare. They essentially took over the rate collection. In other counties, places like Leitrim, they were involved in anti-rates opposition. But one of the recourses that was available to rate collectors who were collecting on behalf of the Dáil was to bring defaulters to the Dáil Courts. But of course, whether this worked or not depended on how well organised the courts were locally and how they operated locally. So if you had a kind of a good, effective, efficient Dáil Court system in your area as a rate collector, that was an option to you. But in other places, it wasn't. And even still, that caused kind of problems. And again, this is all about local judgments and local dynamics. And there were complaints in Carlow and other places that rate collectors were bringing defaulters to Dáil Courts. And you can find records from Leash, for example, where the only items on the agenda are rate defaulters. But they weren't awarding costs to the rate collector. So the rate collector was out of pocket for bringing the defaulter to the Dáil Court. And this meant that, you know, naturally enough, they felt this wasn't an option to go on. So very much as sort of John is saying, this is locally organised, and how quickly they spring up and how they survive and how they operate is really often based on the individuals involved on the ground.
Caoimhe, can I bring you in on this? What was the role of women in the Dáil Courts? I'm thinking of, you know, the Wind That Shakes the Barley. How accurate is the depiction in that movie?
Well, I think that famous scene in The Wind That Shakes the Barley is probably a distillation of a lot of different features of the Dáil Courts. You know, I think it's unlikely that you would have had a scenario that's so perfectly encapsulated Loach's vision in that one setting, but you know, women were in positions of authority. They were district justices, they were magistrates in those Dáil Courts, because the officers of the court were directly elected by local Sinn Féin clubs or Sinn Féin branches, and so women had access to those positions. So lots of prominent women held those positions: Kathleen Clark, Hannah Shee Skeffington, Áine Héireann, Helena Maloney. So they were, you know, they were able to hear cases, and indeed there were some Dáil Courts that stipulated that if there was a case involving a woman, then there had to be a female officer of the court, present on the day. And they held, you know, it was initially, as John and Brian have said, they were dealing with kind of land agitation or land arbitration disputes, but their remit expanded quite rapidly to include what we might term as social issues nowadays. So in Maria Luddy's and Mary O'Dowd's new book on marriage in Ireland, they've identified a range of social issues that come under the remits of the courts: breach of promise, maintenance for deserted wives and children, cases of seduction. And some of those issues did come before the courts as well. So you know, they're quite broad in their remit. The exact scope depends on local circumstances and local conditions. But we do get some, you know, there's a wonderful portrait of the Dáil Courts in Kevin O'Shea's memoir, who was one of these people who was sent out from Dublin, from Dáil Éireann, to try and put some, bring some order and bring some control to these lawless, you know, arbitration courts and this lawless land agitation, that so-called lawless land agitation that's happening out west, particularly in Roscommon. And his memoir is witness statement, it's a very long witness statement, gives a really detailed picture of the evolution of those Dáil Courts and how they functioned, how he was sort of, I think he saw himself as a sort of an envoy of civilization, an envoy of proper legal process, bringing order to the Wild West, as it were. But it's worth reading his memoir.
Now, I want to move on, Patrick, to you, because at the centre of this whole financing operation is Michael Collins, who is the Minister for Finance. How good was he?
It's a good question, Tommy. You know, Michael Collins was, you know, he has this mythical reputation as being a great organiser. And, you know, no matter what side of the debate on the treaty you were, you know, that was almost accepted to this day. And the bottom line is, you know, he was an exceptional organizer, but that was because no different to any organizer of today. It was his ability to delegate. You know, one of the key factors of Collins is he surrounded himself with competence, you know, be it the GHQ intelligence, which was run by two of the co-founders of the New Ireland Assurance business. They had taken a leave of absence, but remained on the management committee to run GHQ intelligence. He had people like Dahi O'Donoghue, who resigned from the civil service because he refused to take the oath of allegiance, who was his right-hand man in financial matters. He had Donal O'Connor, a chartered accountant, who was the official auditor of the Dáil and of the Dáil loan. So all around, Collins were exceptionally competent, exceptionally well-trained people. But what he brought was a scale of vision. You know, this was this 15 or 16-year-old who wanted to go to London because it was the center of the empire. He wanted to go to New York later because that's where he could get on. So he had an incredible scale of vision. And, you know, if you look at the promotion campaign for the Dáil loan, you had, you know, 3 million promotional leaflets, 400,000 copies of the prospectus. He organized a 7-minute promotional film, which, you know, that's the equivalent of an internet campaign today, to have a visual film advertising the loan, and also including, you know, engaging an advertising agency to put full page newspapers adverts in the national and provincial papers. So was he a good minister or minister for finance? For sure, because of those skill sets and the people surrounding him.
Now, his role as Minister for Finance did intersect with his other role as head of intelligence of the IRA, Patrick. And I mean, and this is where much of your source material comes from. Just could you expand on that, his ruthlessness?
Well, I mean, to set up a nation state, you know, is organization and funding. And without funding, you know, we would have no, there would have been no, as Ernest Blythe said, the future Minister of Finance, there would have been no free state. And the funds raised in the Dáil loan, you know, was a substantial amount of money. It came to almost £400,000, almost 25 million, 23 to 25 million euros today. Without that funds, the Dáil courts, the, you know, the other departments, the National Land Bank couldn't have been funded. And when the attempts were made by Dublin Castle to seize those funds, Collins was prepared and did authorize the shooting of the detectives and resident magistrates.
But Dave, Patrick, earlier I was asking you about the sources that you used for your book, and there's one in particular, if you could expand on, who is a victim of Collins's bid to protect his funding operation.
Yeah, so we have Alan Bell was a relatively elderly resident magistrate. He was very near retirement, but he was also a former RIC detective, and he was tasked to go after the Dáil funds. And he instituted what was an incredible, even today would have been incredible, a bank inquiry where 10 bank managers in Dublin were summoned before a Crimes Act inquiry and ordered to bring their books and records. And during those depositions, where we have in the National Archives, the only people allowed under the Crimes Act in the interviews or in the depositions was Alan Bell himself, the witness, and somebody to take the typescript. And we have the full transcripts of those depositions. And this was an incredibly dramatic testimonies by the bank managers and difficult questioning by Alan Bell. And what his questioning reveals and what we can see in his notebooks, which are available in the National Archive, are the detailed information he had gathered on the Dáil administration and on the Dáil loan funds, including where the funds were banked, in whose names they were banked. Some were real names, some were fictitious names. He also identified Dahi O'Donoghue as the key financial person that was working for Collins. So the launching of this inquiry caused a scandal in Dublin. There was a huge nationalist backlash across business, finance, and the church. And when Collins became aware that Alan Bell had come, was very close to getting the funds, he authorized Alan Bell's shooting.
Now, did that stop these inquiries in their tracks, or was this an exemplary execution to discourage the others, if you like, anyone else coming along and launching a similar investigation?
It pretty much marked the end of any investigation into the funds. The only thing that happened, the shooting of Alan Bell was a real turning point in the War of Independence. It effectively partially caused a clear out of the Dublin Castle administration. The only later attempt by the Dublin Castle and the British government to get the funds was Ormond Winter became the new head of police intelligence. And he set up a raid bureau, and he conducted in the region of 6,000 raids in the last 9 months of the War of Independence. But one of the interesting things on that is, one of the things that's, I think, gets lost in the military and intelligence aspect of the discussions on the War of Independence is the professionalism and the administrative capability of the people involved. And the Ormond Winter, the head of the Raid Bureau, said one of the tasks that made his job easier was that the Irish had an irresistible habit of keeping documents. And that was the case. You know, it was a very professional organization, sometimes to the problems for the guys in the field when these documents were seized. But to run a national administration, you had to have professionalism. And, Collins and Richard Mulcahy were professionals.
Now, while all this is going on, right, Eamon de Valera is over in the United States trying to get recognition for the Republic. And of course, he fails to get that. But should Dev get credit for the success of the US bond drive? Maybe Patrick, how do you respond to that?
Yeah, I'll take that, Tommy. To be fair, there was in the region of just over $5 million raised in America. And the bottom line, I would give very little credit to the raising of the funds in America, because two aspects. One, $5 million does sound like a lot of money, but it's when you translate that, it becomes 1 million sterling. In Ireland, it was 400,000 sterling raised at the time. So if you look at the population and the wealth, the amount of funds raised in America actually was not very high. But more importantly, the target in America was $10 million. And De Valera would later say, I said I'd raise 10 million, knowing that I'd only get 5 million. And that's just incorrect. You know, all the media, the prospectus, there was a drive in America to raise $10 million. And they failed, unfortunately, as much as Collins exceeded his target by 50%, De Valera in the States missed his target by 50%.
And of course, he's burning funds himself in his own.
If you take account of the net amount raised, so, 1 million sterling, and the cost of that, year and a half spent in America, the amount of money raised in America wasn't so far above what was raised in Ireland. And also, if you take account that not all of that money actually came to Ireland during the War of Independence.
Well, that's a subject for another hedge school, the Irish press and et cetera. So let's not go there for the moment. John, I think that's an interesting point, because I was always under the impression that the US bond drive was a success. So what you're saying, Patrick, is it was a bit underwhelming. But listen, let's leave that point there and John, move back to you for the situation on the ground. Was there an appreciation of this underground infrastructure by IRA fighters on the ground, or did they have disdain for this whole operation?
Well, just a couple of things. One is, if we go back, and Alan Bell is a good point of this. Alan Bell had been involved in the land war. You know, Cuiva at the start of the program, Cuiva talked about kind of prisoner benefits being a longstanding Irish tradition. There was a whole longstanding Irish tradition of fundraising and covert and subversive fundraising in the land war. In going back to O'Connell and the Catholic Association, there was a whole tradition of underground or illegal courts O'Connell, the Catholic Association had courts. So did the Land League. So these are kind of traditions that are already there, that are already in the arsenal. And there's also a whole tradition of raising funds in America and raising bonds in America. You know, the Fenians and Parnell had done that as well. So anyway, I digress. In terms of all this business, yeah, I think that the IRA activists did not appreciate it. They weren't engaged in it. They didn't like to be drawn into it either. They felt that it was a distraction from their primary purpose. And I think that when we look at the Civil War that is to come, a lot of the people who support the free state are these people who are involved in this nonviolent agitation. Not necessarily the women, but a lot of the Sinn Féin leadership. And we talked a little bit about the GHQ and the group around Collins. And they're really good at this stuff. They're really good at governance, at creating bureaucracy. A lot of them are, and we think about the Republican elite, a lot of them are low-level civil servants. A lot of them have these long-standing organizing backgrounds. And when it comes to setting up a new state, they're actually quite good at it. And especially when the Civil War happens, the Republican, the IRA leadership, the IRA activists who don't focus on this only realize when it's too late how important it is to have this civil administration, to have this mobilizing avenues for your public support. And because all these activities are not just about raising money, they're not just about governance, they're about demonstrating to your supporters and attracting people to your standard and raising the morale of your supporters. And that's another critical aspect of them. And I don't think the IRA flying column guys ever quite understood that. And they probably realized too late in the Civil War what a disadvantage it put them to having ignored it for too long.
Brian, can I bring you in a slightly related question then? How did the truce affect people's attitudes to Dáil / IRA taxes and levies?
I suppose it depends. We can maybe differentiate between the Dáil taxes, you know, the rates and the arms levy, partly because the arms levy happened on the ground. You know, there was an incentive for IRA units to collect for the arms levy in maybe a way there wasn't with collecting something like the rates, which they also became involved in. So the rates could be a distraction, as John has said, whereas the arms levy, you know, they needed that to buy the guns that they needed to fight. So with something like the rates, the truce maybe didn't solve any of the issues that had been present beforehand. And anti-rates agitation carried on right throughout the truce period, right throughout the Civil War. I mean, the anti-treaty IRA were blamed for some of this, perhaps unfairly. But, you know, part of that is because a lot of these were issues that existed with an unpopular tax anyway. And so the rates were never that popular to begin with. And then the cost of the rates increased during the conflict. There's the confusion, the disruption brought about by the conflict, you know, and so all that sort of stuff makes these issues worse. And so they don't go away when the truce came along. The arms levy was that little bit different. GHQ sort of recognised that, you know, the need for an arms levy hadn't gone away because, you know, during the truce period, the IRA are training and arming and equipping for a resumption of hostilities. You know, they have to assume that hostilities are going to start back again. So in that sense, there's a need for an arms levy. But GHQ mandated that the levies couldn't be compulsory. They had to be voluntary. So the idea was you could collect money for an arms fund locally, but you couldn't force anyone to do it against their will. Now, part of that was brought about by complaints that were received by GHQ and even Mulcahy directly. And sort of he's worried at that point then about the perception of the army and about the reputation of the army if civilians are writing in to complain. And they could write in to complain during the truce, maybe in a way that they couldn't beforehand. So the mandate comes down that, you know, these compulsory truces, and they published this in the press, notices saying that IRA levies aren't compulsory anymore, and people again respond to that. But of course, on the ground, you know, local units dictated whether that was the case or not. And it's very easy to blur the lines between compulsory and voluntary, particularly when, you know, men are showing up late at night with guns in their hands.
Now, just to wrap up, right, John Borgonovo has already averted to The the realization by the anti-treaty side, you know, during the Civil War, that they'd missed a trick here in terms of control of this underground infrastructure. So what I want to just discuss is what happened to it. Maybe, Caoimhe, if I go to you first, because earlier you depicted a situation where this underground administration gave employment opportunities to women and they were involved in it. What happened to all of that?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, when the Free State embeds itself and gets properly up and running, wins the Civil War, what you see is a gradual squeezing out of women from public life. Women were sort of informally excluded through the juries. What's it called? The juries. Well, let me go back again. The women were informally excluded through the Juries Amendment Act in 1924, which technically allowed women to opt out as jurors, but in practice, how it worked on the ground was women were sort of set aside onto a standby list and very rarely called to act as jurors. So that's quite a stark contrast between the, you know, the active participation of women in the administration of justice that we saw during the Dáil courts. And then you have differential rates of pay that Ernest Blyth introduced also in the 1920s, whereby married men were paid more than single men and single women. And it would take a single woman far longer to reach the top of her scale than it would take for a single man. So you can see how women are being disincentivized, I suppose, from employment in the public service. And that's another kind of stark contrast with what happened earlier. But in terms of what actually happened to the Dáil courts, I mean, there's for a period, as with much of the Civil War period, that there's a period when you have kind of parallel systems of justice that are operating, when you have the older Dáil courts, very much as we've discussed, locally driven, locally organized. These are still in operation in certain parts of the country. And then you have from Dublin an attempt to kind of reassert full control over the administration of justice. And that new free state system of justice is more in line with the previous, you know, it is modelled on the British system with the British administration, where you have the various circuits, where you have barristers who would have practiced under the British system of justice in Ireland. They, you know, get themselves together and go out on circuit again, as it were, onto the Western Circuit or the Munster Circuit or the Northern Circuit. So for a period of time, there's a period of confusion, actually, where, you know, it's not quite clear where lawful authority is residing. And that's, you know, then eventually, to Kevin O'Higgins and the Ministry for Local Government and Home Affairs do manage to get a control on things. But you do have these kind of pockets of informal justice, I suppose, and the kind of the grassroots legal arenas of the Dáil courts do manage to kind of cling on in there for a few months during the Civil War, but that all kind of rapidly comes to a close.
Okay, Patrick, can I go to you just to wrap up for the final word here? So what happened to this very elaborate funding infrastructure? What I'm getting at is, in the new state that was established, how much of its administrative and funding DNA was revolutionary and how much of it was based on the old British system?
Well, the example I would give, Tommy, is maybe the two startups that were set up during the period, the New Ireland Assurance and the National Land Bank. And on the positive side, you have New Ireland Assurance, which today is, you know, a €1.3 billion sales business. So, you know, a tremendous success, and was a tremendous success from the beginning for, you know, six guys setting up a startup over a shop, actually, in Enniscorthy. And then probably the most disappointing, and coming to the team you're addressing, Tommy, is the National Land Bank, you know, set up to become a financial centre for Ireland, with Michael Collins and Robert Barton being the driving forces. It had become a success. It had issued loans to 40 cooperatives, issued in the region of £340,000 of loans at the time. And as this after the civil, or sorry, just as the truce was signed, it was in a great position. Effectively, a state-owned bank funded by Dáil Éireann using a dummy corporation. It had a strong balance sheet. It had a good business. And but unfortunately, Robert Barton went anti-treaty and lost his position with the bank. And the shooting of Michael Collins meant that the two driving forces behind the bank were gone. And the Free State government was in desperate need of funds. And it relied on the Bank of Ireland for funding, just as Dublin Corporation had to rely on Dublin Corporation for funding when it lost the local government funding through the British government. So the National Land Bank was ultimately acquired by Bank of Ireland, which was heavily ironic because Bank of Ireland, through the Bank Standing Committee, had done everything in its power to stop the National Land Bank getting access to the Czech clearing system, to the point that Collins had to send a message through Dáithí O'Donoghue telling the members of the Standing Committee they would be treated as enemy agents. So, you know, so this great land bank, which was to become the financial center of Ireland, was acquired by Bank of Ireland. And as Dáithí O'Donoghue said, it was an ignoble fate given the work done and the hopes that were there when it was originally set up.
Well, I have to say, what it seems to me then is that the status quo antebellum prevailed. I mean, and this is all the appearance of what John Regan has called a counter-revolution. But I'm going to leave that discussion for another day. Listen, guys, we've run out of time for this. I'd just like to thank our speakers here today, John Borgonovo, Caoimhe MacDavid, Patrick O'Sullivan Green, Brian Hughes. Our next Hedge School next month, by the way, we're going away from the decade of centenaries. I'm going to look at the history of Irish canals. So listeners, I hope you can join us for that. Thank you very much.